This podcast may contain adult language and situations, graphic, gory details, and other not-so-nice things. Listener discretion is advised. I'm Ashley.
And I'm Lacey, and this is United States of Murder. This week, we're in California discussing the untimely death of two college students.
And then, we will talk about a horrifying machete-wielding big bad wolf. So buckle up and join us on this dark and twisted ride through the Golden State.
Who are you beyond the roles that you play in your daily life? After the final curtain call and the lights go down, does your role end? Or do you get lost in the character you've played? Does the character define you, or do you define the character? Surely the doe-eyed, love-struck princess isn't always a damsel in distress. And the goofy, fun-loving neighbor isn't continuously good-hearted behind closed doors. It is possible, sometimes, for the hero of the story to actually be the villain in disguise. No one is always just as they seem. Steve Hare, a retired teacher, had a very close and special bond with his only child, Sam Hare, who was 26 years old and the center of his parents' world. They were best friends, and Steve would stop by Sam's apartment at least once or twice a week. They'd go to the gym together, and then afterwards they'd grab something to eat and head back to Sam's and watch TV. So, Sam had recently returned from a 3-year military tour in Afghanistan and moved into the Camden Martinique Apartments in Costa Mesa, California. So, the OC.
The OC.
Mm-hmm. Yep, he was enrolled in the Orange Coast College in hopes that he would someday become a military officer. The apartment complex was almost like a student dorm in a lot of ways because almost everyone that lived there was also a student at OCC. On Friday, May 21st, 2010, a little more recent than I've been doing recently, so Sam was supposed to attend a barbecue with some friends, and one of his close friends, named Ruben, who also lived at the Camden Apartments, knew that Sam was helping out another friend with something that day, but he still assumed that he was going to make it to the barbecue. So he called and texted him a few times, and eventually got a hold of him, however, it didn't really sound like Sam. The wind was blowing a lot, but Ruben also said that he asked him why he sounds so weird, and he said, "Oh, nothing, I'm just having some family problems, you know, problems with my dad." So immediately, Ruben thought that was super weird. He knew Sam really well, and he knew how close he was with his father, and he knew that he had a really good relationship with both of his parents. So he said automatically he started asking him questions about it, and then he got hung up on. Yeah, so from then on, Ruben could not reach Sam through calls or texts, but so he had a weird feeling. He just kind of let it go, not thinking a ton about it. Well, so that same weekend, Sam's parents were expecting him at their place in Anaheim Hills. So they were thinking he would show up sometime on Saturday, May 22nd, but by the early evening, he still hadn't shown up and wasn't calling or texting for an update, which was kind of weird since they were expecting he'd be there by then, and if not, he would have at least called to say where he was or texted an ETA. So his dad, Steve, decided to drive over to Sam's place in Costa Mesa. When Steve got there, he knocked first, but no one answered. He had a key, so he let himself in. And as he walked in, everything was neat and orderly, as usual. You know, it's a military guy. Has a nice clean apartment. He headed back toward the bedroom and discovered a horrendous scene.
No, what was it?
So, on Friday, May 21st, 23-year-old Julie Kibuishi, Sam's friend and tutor, also went missing.
I'm just very proud of you for pronouncing that.
I hope I'm saying it right.
Probably not,
I put the pronunciation in parentheses, Kibuishi. So, she attended the same college and was tutoring Sam for an anthropology class. So she was studying fashion design there. So that day, several of her friends were trying to get in touch with her, and they were starting to get worried. Her mom, June, also called and texted a bunch of times with no response. So that next morning, you know, Saturday, her mother still hadn't heard back from her, so she called the police to report Julie missing. Okay, so now let's go back to what Steve Hare walked into. When he walked into the bedroom, he saw a body of a woman bent over on the bed with her knees on the ground, and a torso was kind of like slumped over in a kneeling position over Sam's bed.
Like she was praying almost?
Yes, yes, exactly. With a gunshot wound to the back of her head.
Oh God, like execution style.
Mm-hmm. And the back of her jeans were ripped and kind of pulled down. I saw a picture of the jeans. It almost looks like they were just straight ripped down the back. Kind of an unusual tear, honestly. And a tiara was on her head. And later we'll find out her brother gave her that night, so she was already wearing that. Well, written on her sweater read, "All yours, F you."
This does not sound like Orange County behavior.
I agree. So immediately, Steve called 911 to report this, and I listened to the call, and he is so freaked out. He's horrified. He's panicked. He's breathy, all emotions rolled into one. He calls. He's not sure who this girl is, and the operator asks if his son knows. And he answers he doesn't know and that his son's not there. And I can't imagine how Steve felt at that moment. Like, walking in, it's his son, his best friend, who might have murdered someone. And he might be on the run. Like, it's just, you can hear the total panic in his voice when he calls. So immediately, Sam became the main suspect. Of course. You know, it's his apartment. Someone's dead there. He's gone. Police put out an APB and an extensive manhunt began. So Steve, his dad, was super cooperative with the police and search, but he just kept saying he knows Sam would never hurt a woman. And he knew that his background in the military, his knowledge of guns, you know, not a good look. He was worried that that alone would further condemn him and, you know, make everyone think he's responsible for this. But regardless, he was still helpful in trying to find his son because he wanted to know answers too. So, in an attempt to find Sam, Steve looked up Sam's banking records. And what do you know? The card had been recently used at an ATM at Echo's Pizza Parlor in Long Beach. Kind of strange. So the police check this out. In the meantime, Steve starts calling Sam's friends and gets the numbers of people who live in the apartments. He talked to Ruben, and Ruben told him everything he knew, and he made his way down the list, and then he got a hold of a guy named Daniel Wozniak. And Daniel's story instantly shook Steve. He asked Daniel what Sam's disposition was like, and Daniel told him that he was having girl problems and family problems. So Steve knew he and Sam are good. Sam and his mom, Raquel, were fine. No family problems, no recent arguments, no nothing. Why on earth would he be telling people he was having family problems? Like, he couldn't wrap his head around that. And as for girl problems, he wasn't dating anyone. And also hadn't expressed any concerns to any of his closer friends. So kind of odd that he would be telling this one dude this. Well, anyway, so the police track down this whole ATM pizza parlor situation, and they discover it's a 16-year-old teenager who's been, using Sam's card and making deposits. He was actually making multiple $400 deposits.
What?
Yeah, so police confront him. And he tells them that someone else put him up to this. And he claimed that he had been paid by a man to withdraw money. So who put him up to this? Was it Sam? No. The name that he gave police was none other than Daniel Wozniak. So now Daniel Wozniak is surrounded by a lot of red flags. So the police decide to pay him a visit. And they actually end up crashing his bachelor party at Tsunami Sushi in Huntington Beach, the night before his wedding, the night before. And they take him away in handcuffs. Okay, so Daniel Wozniak was a community theater actor. He was a community theater actor. He was also a neighbor of Sam Harris and called himself a friend of his. He was engaged to be married in just 2 days to 23-year-old Rachel Buffett. Rachel was a part of the same community theater scene, and she was a former Disneyland princess.
That would be a fun job.
Yeah, I think it would be fun.
I would want to be Maleficent, though, instead. I would want to be an evil queen.
You'd want to be the villain. Okay, no shame. I like Maleficent. So, the police took Daniel in for questioning, and he put on a show. And a poorly acted one, I will add. So, he gave a bunch of confusing stories. None of them added up, and the dramatic way he talks in these interviews would be comical if it weren't about such an awful crime. During his second interrogation, he breaks and shouts, "I'm crazy and I did it!" And then he starts confessing. Seriously, these interviews of him, they're over the top and ridiculous. He sounds like he's doing some type of monologue. I don't know.
In my mind, he's dancing around like...
It's just so much.
What's her name in Bridesmaids when she's on the plane and she's...
It's ridiculous. It's
over the top.
It's so over the top. I can't even begin to express how over the top it is. So he said on Friday, May 21st, he lured Sam to the theater by asking him to help move some heavy boxes and like stage equipment and stuff. And while Sam was bending over to pick something up, Daniel said he shot Sam in the head. But this did not kill him. In fact, he didn't even know what happened to him. Daniel claims that he said, "I need help. Something hit me. It felt like an electric shock." And then immediately, Daniel shot him again in the head, which was the fatal blow. So Daniel went on to confess that he felt like, after this, he needed to cover up this murder by committing another murder.
Because that always works out for people when they think that way.
Yeah. He thought, hey, let me frame Sam. So that same day, after he killed Sam, he, you know, took his phone and he texted Julie and tricked her into going to Sam's place that night. So the way he was texting her, she thought something was wrong with him and that he needed someone to talk to. Like it was kind of an emergency situation. Well, once she got there, Daniel killed her and staged a sexual assault by ripping her clothing and slumping her over the bed. He said that then he went back to a field and dismembered Sam's body and hid parts in different locations in Orange County.
Ew.
Mm-hmm. So he led police to Sam's body where it was buried at El Dorado Nature Center in Long Beach. Yeah, I don't know where he was getting these ideas. It didn't take much investigating to figure out what his motive was. Want to take a guess?
Money.
Yep. Good job. So it turns out Daniel was in some big financial trouble. He had no full-time job, no money, was on the verge of being evicted from his apartment, and he was getting married in 2 days. So he really wanted money for the honeymoon. He wanted to take a nice Royal Caribbean cruise.
First of all, he couldn't ew. If I ever get married and that's my new husband's idea of a honeymoon is a Royal Caribbean cruise, we're getting it in old immediately.
Oh my gosh. Well, it's like...
No, sir.
They haven't paid their own rent in months. And yeah, they're like, we need money for a nice cruise.
We need a cruise.
The priorities are all out of whack. So at one point, Sam Hare told Daniel about his combat pay. And he said that he was able to save up $62,000 of it.
Dang.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of cruises.
And 400 at a time. 2 days before their wedding, I don't know, the math doesn't even add up for him. He's just not that, no. Anyway, so Sam was such a nice guy that he had been helping Daniel out with his rent. It's just terrible. And that's actually how Daniel was able to get Sam's PIN number. Because they went to the ATM together. Sam was going to withdraw some cash, give it to him for rent. So he watched him type in his number. Isn't that just terrible? Someone's helping you out with your rent in California. I don't even want to know how much that
rent
cost. I can't
even remember my own PIN number, let alone...
Before Daniel made his confession to police, he made some jailhouse phone calls with his fiancée, Rachel. And he begged her to not tell police about any of the evidence against him, including the murder weapon. So Rachel then calmly reminds Daniel that this phone call was being recorded, and they're all recorded. And that as soon as she got off the phone with him, she was going to contact detectives. But not before she had him retell her on the phone what he did to Sam and Julie. Very bizarre, right? She was very calm and collected throughout this entire thing. So now, of course, Rachel looks like she could possibly be involved in this. There was no shock and horror in these phone calls. I've listened to them as well. So what did you do?
Yeah.
It was like she was wanting him to rehash everything on the phone while she was in. Yeah, so strange. So police take her in for questioning, and then they catch her in several lies. So they notice she's parroting a lot of the same false things that Daniel had said before he confessed. And it sounded like that maybe they pre-discussed what they would say if they were interviewed about it, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
They both told police they saw Sam leave the apartment with a mystery man in a black hat. And neither of them could give any more descriptions other than it was a man in a black hat.
That sounds like bullshit.
Yeah. So she also tried to give Daniel an alibi by saying that at the time of the murder, they would have both been in bed, so he wouldn't have done it. All of her interviews are available on YouTube, and throughout the entire interview, she denies over and over that she had any involvement. She also claims that she had no knowledge of either murder and that Daniel had totally pulled the wool over her eyes throughout her entire relationship. They gave her, I think, around 3 lie detection tests, including a voice analyzer. I had never really heard of that before. You know how they normally hook it up, I think, to your heart rate when they give you the test? This is something that goes with your voice to detect how your voice kind of flows and sounds, and they can detect if you're lying in that, apparently. And the cop I was listening to said he usually puts more stock in those than the other ones. I didn't even know about these, so I don't really have an opinion, but she failed all 3. And usually I don't put a lot of stock into this one way or the other, but the officer said when they used this analyzer on her, she would disguise her voice.
Stop.
Right? She would disguise her voice like she was using a technique or something she learned in acting class. So she wouldn't even be talking in her normal tone at all. And they kept saying they had to re-ask her to answer things because it was very almost mumbled and in a weird tone. And it just was totally out of the norm. That's the biggest red flag for me, is not did it come back positive or negative, but she's putting on a fake voice.
That's hilarious.
I wish I could see a video of that. But okay, so something else really bizarre during one of her interviews. She told police that Daniel was a lousy lover.
Shots fired.
And that he didn't have much to work with. But I mean, like, she was going to be marrying this guy in 2 days.
She was going to be cheating on this guy.
And she also said in the interview, she wasn't head over heels in love with him or anything, but she was okay with it. That was what she
said.
Did
she need health insurance?
Well, okay, he didn't have a job.
Oh, so
he didn't have a job.
So he was bad in bed, didn't have had a corn dog, a mini corn dog, and also didn't have a, no.
See, no, no. It doesn't add up. It doesn't add up because.
Was he good looking?
Nah, not really.
No.
I mean, like, he wasn't like a troll, but no, not. I mean, like, just, he's an average looking dude. I guess maybe his acting.
No, he's poor, acting. Bad in bed, and he's an average-looking dude. No.
So what's going on there? Yeah. So it was just kind of out of the blue, too, where she's like, oh, by the way, he's a lousy lover.
She was just trying to be.
Yeah.
Hateful.
Mm-hmm. But do you know you were marrying him in 2 days? And you're just saying, like, yeah, it was okay. Like, yeah, no big deal.
Mm-mm.
Whatever. I mean, one of the phone calls to Daniel, she mentioned, you know, that it was being recorded. And then she started lecturing him and saying, no, we never need the money. We just need to. I'm sorry. It's hard for me to say this because I've listened to her calls. And they both are so over the top and dramatic that it's like it's laughable. So she's like, no, we never need the money. We just need to be good people and have each other.
No.
And then he starts sobbing.
Mm-mm.
No. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. So the interesting thing about her saying this is that in their apartment, they had a safe. And she knew that one of the items in that safe was a sex tape. This just gets weirder and weirder. Was a sex tape that Daniel had of an ex-girlfriend. Yeah. So he had taped. And she didn't know about it. This ex-girlfriend, he taped their sex. It was in a safe, and so Rachel found it. She confronted Daniel, was pissed off about it, of course. But then he explained to her, I filmed this with the purpose of extorting money from her and her family.
Yeah, he sounds like somebody I would want to marry.
But after that, she's like,
okay. And also, you don't make revenge porn. Like, what?
But she seemed to have no problem with it once he explained it was for money.
Oh, so it was from, oh, okay.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, we can keep that in a safe.
No.
So she also claimed that she had no idea that he was in financial trouble. But even her close friends said otherwise. They said she absolutely knew that she and Daniel both stole on a regular basis, including stealing alcohol. One of her bridesmaids told police that Rachel stole the bridesmaids' dresses.
Ew.
How do you do that? So at one point, Rachel told police that Daniel was a pathological liar and he lied constantly. But then later, she told police she had no idea what a liar Daniel was and that she was duped by him. So she was both duped and didn't know he was a liar, but she also knew he was a pathological liar. So it was just like, wait, what now?
No.
I didn't write this down in my notes, so I can't remember it exactly, but there's a podcast I listen to of an ex-boyfriend who talks about that one time they went to Walmart and she was like, hey, I'm going to steal this makeup. And he was like, no, do what you want on your own time. You're not going to do this crap when we're shopping together. I'll buy you what you want. So she gives it to him, and then she was like, hey, I'm going to go back and get something else real fast. So she runs back and brings back a box of perfume, you know, how it used to be in boxes. And they're checking out whatever. It was $5, whatever it was. And then so they get in the parking lot, and she starts giggling. And he's like, what's so funny? And she's like, I replaced that with an expensive bottle of perfume in the box. It wasn't really $5. And he was like, what does it matter? I would have paid for it. And he was like, it's almost like she wanted to see what she could get away with. Like, it was kind of like
a game.
It wasn't about stealing the item.
She was like a klepto.
Yeah, it was like she got off on the thrill of it. And this is from an ex-boyfriend's perspective. So I don't know how the relationship ended. So maybe it went down in flames and he's making this up. That could be a possibility, but it's just what he said. But anyway, moving on. She also went on Dateline and Dr. Phil.
What?
Yes, to declare she was innocent. Oh, my goodness. And I listened to an interview of Steve Hare, the father, and he said he got a call saying, you know, hey, do you want to come on Dr. Phil and talk about your story? And he was like, absolutely not. Nope. Period. And then they're like, well, Rachel Buffett's going to be on and tell her. And then immediately he's like, I'll do it. I'll be on there. Because he was like, I'm not letting her on there by herself to give her side of the story. And I watched some clips and it's an intense episode. At one point, Steve said this, my son is dead and his friend, his tutor, they're both dead. He was cut up into pieces and you come on here and go on TV stations and say, poor me, poor me. That offends me. He was badass when he was talking to her. I will say that. I was just like, he was telling her. He went on to talk about how crushed his life was when the police told him that Sam had been murdered and dismembered. And he said on the show, that's when I lost it. They were looking for his body parts at a park. That was Friday, Saturday, May 29th. That was Sam's birthday. And I'll never forget that on my son's birthday, I was praying that they would find his head.
Oh, gosh.
On December 16th, 2015, this took a while, a jury found Daniel Wozniak guilty of 2 counts of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to death at a September 2016 hearing and was placed on death row. There's a moratorium on the death penalty in California, and so that just means that approximately like the 700 inmates who are on death row now, including Daniel, aren't actually facing execution at this point, but they are technically still on death row. On September 12, 2018, Rachel was convicted on 2 of the 3 instances where she misled investigators. On November 8th of that same year, she was sentenced to 32 months in Orange County Jail. 32 months.
32 months.
Yeah, Judge Sheila Hansen said that the defendant never appreciated the gravity of the crime she committed. Both Sam and Julie's parents believed strongly that she was guilty of way more than she was charged with. But along with the prosecutors, they just didn't really believe there was enough evidence for the jury to convict her of being an accessory to murder. So they all kind of agreed that the only way she would get punished is if they went in for this misleading investigator situation. So unfortunately, they just didn't really have enough on her to feel comfortable with her getting sentenced.
Right.
According to Mercury News, Julie was cremated wearing the tiara her brother gave her the night she died. Her ashes rest in her mother's bedroom in an urn adorned with photos, flowers, and another tiara. When her mom dies, she wants to be cremated and have her ashes mixed in with those of her daughter.
That's sad, but also.
So her mother, June, said this, I believe she's up there in heaven and hopefully I can see her again.
Aww.
It's very sad. Steve and Raquel Hare seek their own comfort at Riverside National Cemetery every weekend. Every weekend they drive out to their son's grave and set up lawn chairs. Steve puts out fresh flowers, reads the paper, and sometimes takes a quick nap before saying goodbye. I know. He said that he's able to find a little bit of peace there. It just broke me.
That's sad.
Sam also had a big tattoo on his chest of a heart, and he had mom and dad written in it. Like, he was very, they had a very, very close bond. That's, like, it just breaks my heart. So, there's a podcast called Sleuth that actually only covers this case. I don't know exactly.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how many episodes they have. I wasn't able to listen to them all in time. But it has a lot of interviews on it. And that's the main reason I was interested. So, including interviews with Steve Hare. I heard a lot of stuff from him. And I love him so much based on these interviews. He's just, you can tell they're just such a good family. And he just wants justice, the truth, whatever. And the host is biased in this podcast. I will admit it. But after you hear Daniel and Rachel in their interrogations, interviews, and phone calls, it's hard not to be. Because even I have my own biases, and I'm not trying to, like, push them in anyone's face. But
right.
Once you – yeah, I don't know. Take it all with a grain of salt. You all watch these interviews, listen to it, decide. Let us know if you have different opinions. That's totally fine. And I'll link, you know, the Dr. Phil episode in our notes. I got a lot of my info from ABC News, the LA Times, and CBS News. And I have a pop culture factoid to add in. So this one's, I was like, what? What's this about now? So on Eminem's 2020 album, Music to be Murdered By, which I know that's like, what's this now? That's your, okay. I know he's all about the shock factor, but that was bizarre. So on Eminem's 2020 album, Music to be Murdered By, side B, he has a song called Killer, and he references Daniel Wozniak.
Really?
Yep. So the lyrics are, I'm just going to try not to laugh through this because this isn't funny. It's just I'm reading Eminem lyrics. But for all of you know, I probably act like I'm Daniel Wozniak. I'm a psychopathic killer. I'm a cap peeler caterpillar with the botanic of bananas you ain't never heard. Should I wrap that? Should I go back and wrap that?
No.
Okay.
You just said that so straight face. You were like, I'm just gonna say it.
How can I like screw up a single word 1,000 times, but I didn't have to record that 15 times?
That's why I busted out laughing.
I'm a cat peeler caterpillar. Okay, but yeah, that's the pop culture. So that's my whole rigmarole of a case. There's so much to unpack, seriously. Like I said, this Sleuth podcast has a lot of it. Some people really have mixed feelings about it because she is very focused on Rachel and her being involved in it. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how she could not be involved in it. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not. Don't come for me. That's the OC.
That is not the same OC that
I've had sushi in the OC.
I've never been to California.
But I've never eaten it. Tsunami.
You should,
what's it called? Well, I went to a different one. I can't remember the name of it, but
that's not the OC I watch on Bravo.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the dark side.
This is the dark side of the OC.
And this is a random thing, but what's her name? Stephanie from the Dallas Housewives.
Yes.
The Real Housewives.
Yes.
Her husband was babysat by a serial killer.
Wait, what?
Or I don't even know all the details. It just popped up on the Oxygen news.
No. We're going to have to
I know. I'm going to have to deep dive into that. But yeah, you know, her husband. Yeah. Stephanie's husband on the Housewives of Dallas.
Random.
So, now what's your case about?
I mean, I don't know if I can follow Eminem's rap.
Sorry. Should I rap my own beat? No.
You should rap the beginning of our podcast from now on.
Yeah. We would get a lot of viewers that way, I'm sure.
Or
listeners.
I think it should open like Fresh Prince.
Oh,
like,
it
should
my
be a
gosh.
Whole rap. But you have to do it.
Oh,
because I am not.
Don't tempt me. Seriously.
I'm here for
don't
it.
Be tempting me. Okay.
So my case happened in San Jose, California in 1984.
Ooh.
So I'm taking it back. You were more... Okay, so back in the 80s, Halloween was more of a family event than it is now, even though it's... I feel like it's kind of been...
Yeah. I feel like it's kind of more about adults now.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Way back in the 80s when I was little, like, it was... You know, kiddos running around and families. Anyways.
I have to ask real fast, sorry, but did you trick-or-treat when it was dark when you were a kid?
Yes. It's like we didn't go till it was dark.
Same. And now...
It was like you trick-or-treated until like 9 o'clock.
I don't have kids, so... But I know based on driving around town...
No, you're done. When it gets dark.
It's during the daytime now.
When it gets dark, you're done.
It's so weird.
I feel like that kind of came... Now, when I was little, in the 80s... So, in 1984, I was 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up in Memphis, West Memphis, and I remember, like, 1 year, it was, like, in the middle of the whole satanic panic thing that was happening in the 80s, that there were supposedly, like, devil worshipers that were targeting or looking for little girls that looked like X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, like... Because it's me and my little sister. I have an older sister, but she's much older than me. I'm sure she appreciates me saying that just now. Sorry.
Woo.
But me and my younger sister, mm-hmm. you know, we're just barely 2 years apart. So I remember my mom being very, like, hovering almost over us all night and making sure.
Right.
And, like, we didn't, like, all of our candy was always checked.
Yeah.
Like, it was when the whole needles and razor
we
blades
had to
and
empty
apples
it all
and,
out. Yeah.
But you would go to houses and get, like, homemade candy apples
or popcorn
balls, which
yes.
were my favorite, or Rice Krispie treats and stuff. And now if somebody gave Max a homemade something, no. I won't even let him take candy from people like in restaurants. I'm like, no, you throw that away right now. You do not take candy from strangers, period. Anyways, Charles and Doreen Herbert, they were married. She was very visibly 8 months pregnant and Deanna was around age 4. That's their little girl. So they lived in like a residential elementary school neighborhood. Like mm-hmm. it was safe. There were kids everywhere and lots of families. So around 9 o'clock, after, you know, most people had called it a night and went in, one of the neighbors hears a banging on her door. She thought, oh, well, maybe a last minute trick-or-treater. So she goes to answer the door and it's Charles. He's covered in blood. He's screaming. And she's, like, trying to shut the door back. Like, because she didn't know who it is. She's
right.
just, like, this man's covered in blood. He's screaming. And she's, like,
yeah, I'd be trying
no.
to shut the door, too.
Like, but he's, like, it's me. It's Charles. It's Charles. He's, like, my wife, she's been stabbed. And he tells her, call 911. And he says, I can't find Deanna, their 4-year-old. So he runs back to the house. So around, little backstory, around... 8:45, he left,
mm-hmm.
8:30, 8:45, he left, ran to the liquor store, and came back. I guess, it, you know, probably at the end of their whatever. So when he comes back, this is when he comes in on the scene. So he had taken Deanna around the neighborhood trick-or-treating and was gone, like I said, about 20 minutes or so. When he comes back, he sees that the front door is kind of ajar, like it's open, and he's like, I told them to, you know, shut the lights, that no more trick-or-treaters. And, you know, probably thinking the 4-year-old had left the door open after giving candy or whatever. So he pushes the front door open and finds his 8-month pregnant wife laying in the hallway in a pool of blood. So much blood that he slips and falls in it trying to get to her.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. She is still breathing, but barely. So he's yelling out for Deanna. He can't find her.
Oh my gosh.
And then he runs out to his neighbors. Well, he grabs the phone and like it's not like 911, it's not going through to 911. So he ends up calling the fire department.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then he goes to the neighbors and is like, you know, I just came home. I can't find Deanna. Call 911. I'm going to go back over here and try to help her get an ambulance.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But when he runs back, he yells for his daughter again, and she comes out from behind the couch. She had been hiding.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. She says later in an interview, you know, that she had poked her head out a few times, but went back into her hiding spot. Mm-hmm. And then when her dad came home, she still wasn't sure that it was her dad, and she's terrified. So she stays.
Well, that's... She had the right idea.
She's four, yeah. And she's just witnessed this horrible... Yeah. So, paramedics get there. Doreen has a pulse. It's very faint.
Wow.
So they're loading her up to take her to the hospital. And, I mean, she doesn't have any stab wounds on her. She has, like, hack marks to her torso, her head, across her stomach, her lower abdomen. Yeah, she's, like, hacked. Like, it looked like someone was, like, raising their arm up and down, like, slashing. Yeah. And there was so much blood, like the paramedics and police both talk in interviews about the smell, how bad the smell of blood was. Mm. So as they're bringing her out, her husband Charles is trying to go with her. He's, you know, kind of acting bananas and he's screaming and they smell alcohol on him. But, I mean, it's Halloween night. You're walking around your neighborhood. I mean... I carry a white claw with me when I trick-or-treat with Max this year. I mean, you're walking around your neighborhood, you're with your kids, you're not driving. Like, you know, there was a couple of moms that we all walked together and, you know, you're hanging out with your buddies and everybody's trick-or-treating. So they smelled alcohol on him. He's acting crazy. His wife is stabbed. Guilty.
Yeah.
I mean, he's the prime suspect.
Of course.
They're trying to get, you know, like, questioning him, getting answers out of him, anything, but... The only thing he's telling them is, I found her like this.
Yeah.
I don't know. I found her. So he's, like I said, covered in blood, drinking, husband, prime suspect. Yeah. So they finally put him in the cop car, the back of the cop car, and he goes ape shit. Like, he is in there for like an, you know, 20, 30 minutes, and he is like kicking it and trying to break the windows, trying to get out. I mean, his just found his wife stabbed to essentially death. Yeah. He, you know, his daughter was there. Like, it just, in the span of 20 minutes that he was gone, this happens.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see why it kind of looks like.
Yeah, no. Mm.
So cops go inside and search the house to make sure that there's no body in there. Like, we don't know if this person's still in there. And like I said, they found blood everywhere. It was like... gaping, like, in the door frame and the ceiling, there were big chunks whoever had this big, heavy, whatever they used, would hit the ceiling with that much force that they were knocking it out. And then some pictures we'll put on our Instagram and Facebook and stuff. There is, like, a single jack-o'-lantern, like, sitting on a stool, like, in the... like, I guess, leading into the kitchen, that's, like, sprayed with blood. Like, it looks like a Stephen King or a John Carpenter movie. It looks very ominous. So, you know, they're working the crime scene. They find the marks on the ceiling, about three of them. It looks like it's made with, like, a meat cleaver or a machete. There's no one in the house, though. They search it, and there's no one there. There's no sign of forced entry, so she must have let whoever did this in the house.
Right.
So they're, you know, working the scene, and they find a wolf mask, like a cartoon big bad wolf, in the corner, like in the bushes by the porch.
Oh, no.
Like it had been tossed there.
Yeah.
So at the station, Charles is strip searched, his clothes are processed, he's still screaming that he didn't do it. And he needs to see his wife. He wants to see his wife. And that's when the cops tell him, you know, look, your wife is dead. And so is your unborn son.
Oof.
So, like, that's how he finds out.
That's so bad.
Yeah. So, it was, yeah. Police start calling around all over trying to figure out what store this mask came from. Because they're asking him. And he's like, I don't know what's wrong. I've never seen this mask. So, they're, you know, trying to figure out where it came from. Trying to tie up some, you know, trying to find a trail, a paper trail. Couldn't find anything. So, you know, again, they ask the husband. He has no idea. He says he's never seen it. They show it to him. They still don't believe him. They're like, you know something. It was just too convenient that you were gone and this happens.
But so the daughter was there and she was four.
Mm-hmm.
Did police ask her, was it your dad?
She didn't see who it was.
Oh, okay.
She didn't see.
I see.
Who it was. And I'll get into that later, but.
So it's not like she was a witness. Kind of, obviously. But yeah. Okay.
So, when police did interview her, they basically said, you know, did you see who it was? And she said that she heard, her and her mom were sitting on the couch. She heard a bang at the door, like an angry bang, like not like a trick or treat, like a bam, 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 bam. So her mom, like big pregnant, gets up, like goes to the door, like almost scared, like what it, like it startled her. And so she opens the door and like almost gets into an argument, but Deanna can't see who is on because she was sitting on the couch. She can't see who's at the door. And she hears her mom say, get out of my house or something like that. And the next thing, her mom turns and looks at her and says, go hide.
Oh my gosh.
And she does. She does exactly what her mom says. Wow. And she hides behind, gets down under behind the couch. And at one point, you know, she's hearing her mom scream. She knows something is going on. She does peek out and grabs her little blanket.
Oh my goodness.
And pulls it back down. I know it makes me like tear up thinking about it. Like Max has his little Nana's is what he calls his blankets. And like, I can't even, oh God. So, and then she peeks out like maybe one more time and sees her mom and she goes back and hides.
Oh my gosh.
So then this person who, this man who has just done this to her mother starts walking through the house yelling her name.
Oh my gosh.
Deanna, come out. Come out. Where are you? Where are you?
Oh, no, 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 no.
I can't imagine being four, hearing and seeing all this, hiding from someone in a big bad wolf mask with a machete.
No.
Screaming and calling my name and you having to hide. So something spooks whoever this person is and they leave. So that's how she survives. They didn't find her. She never moved and she did not come out. And
what type of monster wants to look for a little?
I know it's awful.
So he knew her name, though.
Yeah, he knew her name. So the cops that are still at the scene, they're talking to the neighbors and other people that had been trick or treating that night, and they all report seeing a man with the mask on, carrying a bag that looked like something heavy.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't see what it was, but they just saw him kind of standing even in the distance, like staring at their house, which is creepy.
Mm-hmm.
They also see a trail of blood that leads from the Herbert's house to a pedestrian bridge. So they follow it across the pedestrian bridge to the other side, and it stops.
Really? So just suddenly?
So it's like whoever got into a vehicle or somebody picked him up or something. Yeah, because it just, like, stops.
Got it.
So there's lots of interesting things they're finding. So back at the police station, the cops, you know, they're still talking to Charles about his wife and, you know, kind of getting stuff about, like, so were you happily married? You know, just kind of like they do, interrogating him. About, so were there trouble in your marriage, blah, blah, blah. Charles says him and Doreen met in the late 70s in San Jose. She was a single mom and a physical therapist and had a son named Paul who was around 2. And that she had had car trouble and he came along and helped her.
Wow.
What a little meet cute. It's like a romantic comedy. Like your car was broke down. No, if my car broke down and some dude stopped to help me.
Yeah, I'd be like, get away from me.
Yes, you would have your little cat thing on your keys. Like,
I'm going to stab you. Exactly. Get away from me.
So he helped her and sparks flew. They started dating. He was, you know, she liked the fact that he was a stable guy. He had his own carpet business. He owned a home and he was doing well. And she, as a single mom, like that appealed to her. She was young. So they both loved the outdoors, and her and Charles and 2-year-old Paul would, you know, take part in hiking and camping, and he was, you know, like a surrogate father to Paul. Mm-hmm. He didn't have any children of his own, and they became really close. Michael, Paul's dad is Doreen's ex-husband.
Gotcha.
He lived nearby them. You know, they got married 2 years after dating, and she quit her job and started working with Charles at... Am I confusing you?
No, she started working with her new...
Her new husband. Yeah, she quit her job, started working with her new husband, and they lived close to her ex-husband. So okay, she
so
got...
he was still in
Yeah, he was still in
the
picture.
Kid's life.
Yes. Okay. Yes. They lived about 6 blocks from each other, and even though she had full custody of Paul, he would walk over to their house and, like, have dinner or pick Paul up and take him for the day or the night or whatever. And so, I mean, it wasn't a amicable divorce, but they got along for the sake of Paul. In the fall of 1979, Doreen and Charles had baby Deanna. And they had kind of their perfect family. Okay. They had Paul, her son from her previous marriage, and then now they had a child of their own.
Got it.
So when Deanna was a baby and Paul was around 3, there was a terrible accident.
Oh, no.
The house that they lived in had a pool in the backyard, and Doreen's dog actually drowned.
Oh, my gosh.
In the pool.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. And when that happened, her ex-husband, Mike, is what people called him, you know, was like, hey, I'm really worried about Paul getting into the pool. So if you want to put a fence up, which I think you should, I will pay for it all, or I'll pay for half of it. Just let me know. She ends up putting a fence around the pool.
So they, I guess it's the 70s, because I know now.
Yeah.
It's a requirement to have a fence around a pool.
Yeah, for, this is like...
legal reasons.
Yeah, this is like 79, 80. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so...
Oh, my gosh.
So she... You, no, I
just
can't.
Just having a pool with no fence?
Nothing. Oh, and two small children and a dog? I don't know. Well, I mean, and like you said, the legal aspect of it is like, you know, Max is 7. Mm-hmm. And can swim, but if we lived beside somebody who had a pool that didn't have a fence around it, it would terrify me.
Yeah, my mom got a pool. I just started college, so I didn't get to grow up with it.
Oh, thanks, Mom.
Yeah, but she had a certain amount of time where she had to get a pool or a fence put around
it. Right. Or they did get a fence put
Thank
around the
goodness.
Pool.
But did they get...
So there is a fence around the pool. Okay. So one afternoon, Paul is out back playing. He's 3 and a half now.
Okay.
Baby Deanna is in the house with mom. Mom's watching out the window, you know, checking on him. She's putting dishes away, something, whatever. But she keeps checking on him. You also got to remember this is the 80s, early
80s. And like nobody. I said 70s.
Like, well, it was like 79,
like
80.
Like on the cusp.
Yeah.
Oh my. So he was playing.
So he's playing outside. I mean, he's 3 and a half. Max probably played outside at 3 and a half. We also did. I mean, anyways.
Did they have a. Okay, so...
So he's in the backyard playing with, like, a ball or whatever.
Not in the pool area.
No. Okay. So he's in the backyard playing. There is a fence around the pool. Mm-hmm. Well, she goes and looks out the window, and she doesn't see him.
Oh, my goodness.
That is, as a mother, I can't even imagine. Like, I couldn't find Max one time, and he... your heart
that
stops.
I can't even think about how scary that would be.
So she... Instantly, you know, she runs outside. She's yelling his name. There is, like, a space by the fence that he squeezed through.
Oh,
and
my
she,
gosh.
I know. I'm sorry. And she found him floating in the pool. So she goes to the neighbors. They call 911. Yada, yada, yada. He's in the hospital. They unplug him off life support,
oh,
and he dies after 3 days.
And how old was he, 2, 3?
3 and a half.
Oh.
This was in February, and he would have been 4 in April, I believe.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it just gives me a knot in my throat. So, yeah, it was awful. So, Michael, the ex-husband, just doesn't feel like she's sad enough. Like, he doesn't, and I know everybody grieves differently, and grief is in different forms. Like, you may, some people are angry. Some people can't get out of bed. Some people become workaholics. Like, everyone deals differently. He didn't think she was sad enough. He blamed her for the death, said she should have been watching him. Maybe she was preoccupied with her new baby and her new family. And so he ends up suing Doreen and Charles for gross negligence.
Wow.
Which is basically lack of any care or prevention of care. So he sues them, takes them to court. He loses the case. You know, he was angry.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you and I talked about this, you know, last night, and it's like, you know, when something terrible happens, you want to put blame on some reason why somebody, and he just...
It can be a lot easier to deal with something if it's...
As there's awful, yes. A blame.
Like, just something being an accident, it's hard to wrap your mind around that.
Especially when it's the loss of your child in such a traumatic way of getting in a pool and drowning, especially after he told her, like, this worries me, this concerns me. Your dog has died. We have a young child. Like, why were you, you know, these are red flags already. Why are you not outside with him?
Yeah.
I know. I'm playing the devil's advocate. So anyways, so after the trial, Charles, Doreen's new husband, told Mike, do not ever come back around us. You're not welcome back at our home. And, you know, they had fought after Paul's death about his last child support check to Doreen, funeral costs. Like, it was just, everybody was hurt, I'm sure, can't imagine, and it was a mess, and it ended up going to court, and he tried to sue him for negligence, and anyway, so they were like, that was, stay away from us.
Yeah.
Like, we're done. So they had zero contact for years, and he just, obviously, as he would, probably got angrier and angrier at Doreen because he believed she let Paul die on purpose, that she wanted rid of him to start her new family.
Wow. So he was kind of
putting
thoughts in his head of, oh my goodness.
Maybe she did this, not that she drowned him, but she was deliberately not watching him so she could cut ties with Michael and have Paul out of her life and Michael out of her life and move on with her perfect family and her new husband and her house and, you know, and start a new family. That was his mindset. He actually did go to counseling and it helped.
Okay.
So he quit. He was, you know, like, I'm good. So I don't, people keep going to therapy.
Yeah.
It's just because you're feeling better. It's still helpful. So in 1984, he was demoted from his job. So he went from making roughly $17 an hour down to like $13 an hour, which, and lost. So he's just kind of, I mean, it's just blow after blow for this guy. And, you know, he's, which I'm sure he probably was dealing with the loss of his son and had some depression. You know, he and Paul were super close. And one of the things he did say later on was that he had Paul the night before and took him home, and he was crying to stay with his dad. Like, I don't want to go home. I want to stay with you, Daddy. And he was like, no, you have to go to your mom's. And then he left, and that afternoon he drowned. So I'm sure just that guilt of, oh, it makes me, like, I have tears in my eyes. Like, I can't. It sounds like.
Yeah, even though, I mean, I don't know because I don't have a child and I haven't had this. But I'm sure even though he was putting the blame on her and was angry at her, he was probably angry with himself.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure he blamed himself. And that's why he, you know, blamed her. He said he was the only one sad. And he just.
Was he single?
Yes.
He didn't have a new woman or anything?
He was single and lived with his mom.
Okay.
And, or his mother had like an apartment in the back of his house or, I don't know. Just kind of sounds like he became overwhelmed by everything. So back at the police station, you know, they're questioning Charles, checking everything out. And, I mean, his alibi checks out. So he's released.
And they're not thinking about the ex-husband
yet?
Well,
they go to the ex-husband's house to, you know, just kind of check things out as, you know, they're interrogating, you know, Charles, the husband. he's the one that's kind of telling this whole story, like, this is what happened. Mm. This is how I met her. Everything was great. And then Paul died. And then, you know, we had some problems with the ex-husband. And so the cops are kind of going, ding, ding, ding. Like, we're putting some things together. So they're like, okay, you know, like, send a squad car over there. Just kind of get, you know, see what's going on. If he's home, like, whatever, blah, blah, blah. So the police get there and they knock on the door, knock on the door. He's not answering. They see a light up in his house, like a hall light, bedroom light, something. But he's not, he won't come to the door. So this is around 12:30 that night.
Same night.
Same night. Okay. Well, now it's November 1st.
Sure.
So they call back to dispatch and they're like, hey, can you call his house and tell him we are outside? Like, come to the door. So here in a few minutes, that light goes off. Another light comes on. He comes downstairs, like, in a bathrobe. Like, maybe he had been asleep or something, but they're like, no, we don't buy it. So they tell him, you know, there's something we need to talk to you about. Do you mind if we come inside? And he's like, yeah, no, sure, that's fine. So they go in the kitchen and they're sitting at the table with them and they're like, so your ex-wife, Doreen, has been murdered. And he just kind of very matter-of-factly says, you're kidding. And they're like, no, we're not. So, you know, they're kind of looking around and noticing things. He's got bandages on his hand. And so they're like, what happened to your hand? And like, his hand is bandaged to the point where it's like there's blood soaked through the bandages. Yeah. So they're like, what happened to your hand? He's like, oh, I was throwing a knife up and I accidentally caught it by the blade. Like, he was goofing off. That's what he told them. I know.
Convenient.
Yeah. So police ask for his ID. He goes upstairs to get it. A cop follows him because he's like, I don't trust this guy. Like, there's.
Is he allowed to do that at this point?
To follow him? Mm-hmm. I mean, he can go with them. He let them in.
Oh, okay.
They're not searching. They're just in the house.
I see.
So he's going upstairs to get his ID. And this cop's like, I'm going to follow him. Because
what's he hiding?
I mean, if he did this, he's a loose cannon. Yeah. Anyways. So the officer follows him upstairs. He was acting super weird. Like, acting like, oh, maybe it's over here. Maybe it's over there. You know, like, he didn't know where his wallet was. Mm-hmm. And he kept kind of looking at the head of his bed. So the cop's like, So the cop looks on the dresser and he's like, here's your wallet. And he's like, oh, there it is. So he gives him his ID and all that. And he's like, okay, let's go back downstairs. Well, while he's up there, he sees a pair of bloody pants, like jeans, by the bed. Also later, when they really search the house, they find a handgun up by the head of the bed. So okay. He was, you know, that was their whole thing, is like, he's acting, he could have got that gun and killed him. He would have, or himself. He probably would have killed himself. So anyways, they get the ID. He, you know, he lets the police search his house. He agrees to it. In the garage, they find blood drops that end in front of the washer and dryer. Yeah, there's blood. Yeah. This truck was dusty, but the driver's window and door was wiped recently. There was blood on the ignition switch and radio switch. There was blood on a piece of rope in the back of the truck. And there was blood on the seat and the steering column and the rubber mat under the gas pedal, like the floor mat. There was blood on all that. Mm-hmm. That blood would later match Doreen's.
Wow.
They did get a search warrant, and they found a label off of an 18-inch machete, like the sticker that comes on them with, like, the barcode. They found that up in his room. I'm like, really? Why'd you keep that?
That, yeah.
Yeah. Insane. In the garage, they found two coffins.
Wait, what?
Yes. He had made, like, two wooden coffins. Yeah. And two anchors.
These were pre-made. He wasn't in their...
Yeah.
Okay. So this was planned.
Yeah.
Okay, wow.
Two wooden coffins and two anchors.
Chilling. Yeah. Oh. Oh, so he's just in there working on coffins? Okay. No.
So in the kitchen, they find blood drops, blood-stained jeans in the bedroom. I told you that. Bloody galls in the bathroom, in the trash. Yeah. It's, like...
If he's planning that, why all the mess? And, you know, it's just... It seems...
Strictly speculating, yeah. I think... What I think is he's already sad. He's missing his kid. She's pregnant, about to have baby number two with new husband. And I think maybe all the kids and the trick-or-treating and stuff just kind of, he just got overwhelmed with missing his own son and missing, he should be doing all those things. He should have all those things. Like maybe he...
Like he was planning a murder, but that triggered him early or something.
Yeah, like maybe. Well,
speculating, obviously.
But in court, he does say that he had planned to drown Charles and Doreen.
Oh, so he planned on killing.
He was gonna.
Well.
He would. Okay. Yes, he didn't know he wasn't going to be home.
I see.
So he had planned on drowning Charles and Doreen. Putting them in the coffins, wrapping the chain and the anchors, and dumping them into the ocean and letting them drown like they let his son drown.
Oh, my.
And then something just, like I said, maybe the kids trick-or-treating, maybe him missing his son, maybe the fact that they lived so close and that she was just going on like everything was fine and he's in his personal hell of grief over the loss of his child. And he just snaps and just. So, anyways. I know. We haven't even got to, like, the bad stuff yet.
What?
I know. So Michael was arrested. He waived his rights and agreed to a taped interview where he at first denied killing Doreen. He said he finished work around 4, ate with his mom around 6 or 6:30, gave some candy to trick-or-treaters, and a neighbor actually would confirm that he... was going by there and gave mail that had been misdelivered to his house to Mike and his mom around 6 or 6:30. And he told him that he was going to a Halloween party. And then Mike's like, oh, yeah. And then I went to a Halloween party. So they're like, speaking of Halloween parties, what kind of costumes have you ever worn? And so he names off all these different costumes, but he doesn't say anything about the Big Bad Wolf costume. But upon further investigation, they actually tracked down a woman who went to a Halloween party with him the year before, dressed as Little Red Riding Hood, and he was the Big Bad Wolf, and she had a Polaroid. And it was the same mask.
Wow.
Dun, dun, dun. So, again, like I said, they asked him about his hand when he was being interviewed, and he said he had, you know, thrown up the knife and caught it. Sure, Jan. So... I know. The trial begins July of 88. The defense would say that mental illness played a huge part in this attack and that it was not deliberate or premeditated that he was delusional after Paul's drowning 4 years earlier. Psychiatrists would testify that Michael believed Doreen wanted their son to die to be rid of him and any ties that she had to Michael so that she could move on with her family and, you know, start all over again. Mike had actually told a coworker the same thing, that he believed she killed Paul by not jumping in to save him and by not watching him properly. So that's sad. He was like even telling other people that he felt that way. So Deanna, the little girl, actually testifies in court. So by now she's 8 years old, and which blows my mind because she's a year older than Max. And I could not imagine him being a reliable witness, but B, having to testify.
She was 4 when it all went down.
Yeah, yeah. She remembered some things that had happened, not everything. Like she could say that, you know, I did not see who it was. I I remember, you know, like peeking out from behind the couch, but then going back. My mom and him, I think I heard my mom say his name. I think I heard her say Michael, but, you know, I mean, also she was four. And so I don't know how reliable children witnesses are. I don't know. I'm not saying she's lying. You know what I mean?
No,
like, I'm
I
not
understand.
Saying she's lying.
I mean, yeah, I know. Yeah.
So I know this is going to be graphic. The autopsy, you know, the person who did the autopsy had to testify in court about the injury sustained and what was the actual cause of death. And it does involve a pretty gruesome murder and a fetus. So if you want to skip ahead, I'm giving you a trigger warning now to turn it off. So the autopsy that was done on Doreen would show that there was slashing and chopping to the front and back of her head, so deep that it penetrated her brain. Her left hand had been severed above the wrist, and she had cuts all the way to her bones. One severed the head of the humerus, and one fractured her femur. She had three stabs to her right breast, a 9-inch gaping wound to her abdomen, which caused her stomach to open, and her large bowel was cut. She had cuts to her uterus, and 18-inch cut all the way through it. This is all while the baby is still inside.
Was this all with the same machete?
Yes.
Okay.
Wow. He came in the door, pushed his way through. They never left the hallway. Like, he attacked her right inside the door, like the breezeway. So this is all while the baby's still inside of her. The placenta had four cuts to it, as well as the umbilical cord. One severed it near where the fetus was attached. The fetus had cuts to his head. So one of the cut that, you know, was all the way across her abdomen, and at some point the wound was open and it expelled the baby.
Okay.
Like the baby.
It came out.
Came out.
Okay.
So the fetus had a cut to his head that penetrated to the bone. His left shoulder blade was cut through the back. He had cuts to the back of his right thigh. His left leg was severed right below the knee. He had a 5-inch cut through half of his little body that severed his thoracic vertebrae, the liver, and it transcended to the heart.
How far along was she?
8.5 months. If he had been born at a hospital, he was viable. He would have lived.
Did he do this while it was still in her or after he fell
all these
out?
Cuts?
Like, was it?
I don't know. I didn't see anything that said that it was.
I mean, none of it makes it any better. But
no.
I just wondered if he was attacking her.
If
it was in process or
it
if could it came
have,
out.
It could have been. It could have been.
Holy cow.
The autopsy also showed that there was no air in his lungs, meaning that he never lived outside of Doreen. So that's probably exactly what you said. It's probably exactly what happened, that this all happened while he was still,
like,
inside of her.
Oh.
Yeah. So after all of these things happen, you know, that's when he goes through the house and is looking for. Yeah. Yeah.
I can't. Ugh.
I know. It's awful. It's awful. Prosecution would go on to say that he was bitter about the divorce. He had lost the wrongful death suit. And that Paul's death just, you know, kind of severed the last tie he had with Doreen. And that was it. That he was gunning for her. He wanted to make her pay. And, I mean, that was that. I mean, they really don't have to prove a lot. I mean, they've got everything, you know. There probably wasn't a lot that they, you know, they would say that, you know, husband comes home, he finds a bloody mess, he, you know, his wife, he sees the fetus, which was in the living room. She was in the hallway. So it had to have been almost tossed into the other room. I know. I told you this is. So he sees the fetus and thinks, oh my God, she must have miscarried. and something happens. So he kind of goes to where the baby is, and he sees her left hand that had been severed laying beside the baby. I know. So then he knows, okay, this is, you know, and that's when he, you know, slips and falls in the blood, and he goes, tries to call, and then he goes to the neighbors, and like all this shit is happening, and he's like screaming for his daughter, and she's not coming out because, I mean, it's just, anyways, yeah, it was a lot. Yeah, it's a lot.
I just have to wonder if Deanna answered the door first. Would he have at least waited for the mom, or would he have started swinging?
Right. Who?
It's horrible.
Yeah, who knows? So the jury finds Michael guilty of first-degree murder for his ex-wife and guilty of second-degree murder for the fetus. So he sobs before sentence is passed by the jury, saying, "If my death could bring back my baby boy, Paul, then you could take me now." I'm not playing devil's advocate, and it's not that I have sympathy for this murderer, but it's like, this man's just, he's done. He's done. So he was, you know, the jury did return a verdict of death. They gave him the death penalty. And the sentence says he was sentenced to death by gas and is in San Quentin in prison. However, in 2019, the California governor signed an order stopping all executions, saying the death penalty is a failure. And there have been no executions in California since 2006. So he is still in prison on death row.
Same with my guy. Interesting that both of our guys are on death row.
That was a lot. That case, like, yeah. I don't know. It's like you have so many emotions when you, you know, read and see everything that happened, you know, like, and I know I say this a bazillion times, but it's like when you're a parent and you think about losing your child and you feel like it's at the fault of, you know, if you're divorced or even if you're not divorced, it's like, I'm telling you now, if something happened to Max, like, you would have to dig two graves, because there's no way I could even think about going on without my child. And I know I'm not alone. And yeah, the majority, I hope all parents feel that way. Like, you can't even imagine. Like, I get teary eyed thinking about it. How would you go on? So it's like, you almost sympathize with.
Yeah. This is the first time I've seen you teared up.
I do not get emotional. But when it comes to my child, like, that's my Achilles heel. So, you know, you almost sympathize with the guy. I'm not saying what he did was. Yeah. Obviously, it was awful. And then you also sympathize with that little baby, you know, Deanna. Yeah. Like, that was her mom and her little brother. All, and it's just a shitty freaking case all the way around. And it's awful that he lost his child. It's awful that she lost her mom. It's awful that he lost his wife. You know, it's just, everybody loses. It was an awful.
Yeah, because murder is never the right solution.
Never.
But I've also never been in a place that dark to.
That's exactly my point. Is you hear like stories of like the vigilante killers who, like, we need to do a special on that.
Yeah.
On people who. But my whole point is like, you hear these stories of somebody catching their, you know, like, their wife being raped, and then they kill somebody. And you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, when you're in, I don't know. Yeah. You know, I just don't. Yeah. Awful. This case was Sucksville. I was telling you. Ugh.
I didn't plan any palate cleansers for this one. But it just, yeah, like, my thing always is anyone is capable of anything.
100%. You never underestimate what someone's power over their emotion. Yeah. Like, your emotions, you can really get the best of you.
Wow. Oof. That's, oh man. Wah, wah, wah. Yeah, I'd love to know more about, so how, do you remember off the top of your head how many years had passed since his son died and when he killed
him? About four.
4 years had
passed. Probably three or four, because when he drowned, Deanna was a baby.
Okay.
And then she was four, so I'm not great at math.
Did he ever get into when he started planning it or making the coffins?
I think probably, I don't know.
Because it's one of those things I wonder.
I'm just speculating.
What made him, just the psychology of it all. You know, what made him decide,
you need to talk to your husband about psychology stuff, but he won't.
Yeah.
But, you know, you would think that it would probably, again, speculating, you know, I think it was kind of, it just all came to a head. There's like, you know, it's the child support, last child support check. You know what? Our kid's dead and you're worried about money. And then, you know, the cost of the funeral and then the lawsuit and then don't ever come around us and stay away from us. And, you know, it's just probably all was a catalyst to.
Yeah. And it's like when they're, when people are looking for serial killers and that kind of thing, they always kind of track down, okay, well, something must have triggered this. Or so even just something as small as him getting demoted, for whatever reason, I don't know why that can just, it's
the
unrelated.
The straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, it's like that. It's not necessarily related, but it's something happens. I don't know. It's just.
Sometimes it's that takes the smallest thing to make somebody say, all right, that's it. I'm done.
I've got to bribe one of my psych friends to get on here and talk to us about it.
Yes. So where are we next week? Lord, let's shut this down. I'm depressed. Go pick my baby up and kiss his little face off. Oof.
I know. It's all sad. We're going to Michigan.
Michigan. What is that? The land of... Is that the land of lakes?
Maybe.
I don't know. Is that the butter? That's land of lakes. Did I just do a Jessica Simpson chicken of the sea thing? What the... TM.
There is, I think, a land of lakes, Florida, but...
No, what is it? Hang on. Go ahead. Keep talking.
Michigan is the mitten. The mitten.
That's what it's known for?
In the Upper Peninsula? I don't know what
that's what I was saying. Is it the land of lakes? I'm wrong. It's the Great Lakes State.
The Great Lakes
Winter
State.
Water Winter Wonderland, or the Wolverine State.
Ooh.
So, well, we will... discover more about Michigan next week.
If you haven't already, follow us on Instagram at United States of Murder. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at US of M Podcast. We're on Patreon now. I posted some of the videos of my zip tie fails. And so Ashley brought some heavy duty handcuffs with her today. And that's something maybe... Let's see if I am better at getting out of handcuffs or if Ashley is. Who knows? But we're going to attempt some more fun stuff. We have a new special sticker for patrons only. You can go to patreon.com/United States of Murder for more info on the tiers and types of things. And, oh, if you like what you hear, leave us a review. That's kind of the way we pop up higher on the rankings and stuff. So, yeah, we'd love for you to do that and join us next week in Michigan.
Bye.
Bye.